This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off for the Memorial Day holiday, so please enjoy this encore Bradcast, originally recorded on May 22nd, 2024.
I would have no problem testifying. I didn't do anything wrong. No, I'm testifying. I tell the truth. I mean, all I can do is tell the truth.
Do you plan to testify in court?
Probably so. I would like to. I mean, I think so.
Will you testify in your own defense?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And by, oh, yes, absolutely, he means, oh, yes, absolutely not.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also elsewhere in California, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Ohio, New York, Louisiana, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Arkansas, Washington State, West Virginia, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and streaming on the internet at most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. All right, coming up is what may be our final, Desi Doyen, our final New York Trump trial midweek catch-up with a K show.
Wow.
The most delicious kind, by the way. Given that both the prosecution and defense have now rested in Trump's hush money / 2016 election interference trial, with each side set to give their closing arguments beginning on the Tuesday after Memorial Day, after the Memorial Day holiday, and the case being charged to the jury for deliberation shortly thereafter.
So that's one down, three more to go.
Well, it's
potentially
not, and it's not down yet. And
true.
Yeah, those three, we'll see. Anyway, so we will see. We may be off for a holiday break when the verdict comes back. We will see. But for now, we've got a lot to get to today as Trump's defense team took what might arguably have been a win at the end of the prosecution's case with what they pretended to be as a lie in Michael Cohen's testimony. They took that potential win and turned it into, well, we'll see, but when they put a guy named Robert Costello onto the stand, presumably a last-minute decision, arguably at the behest of Donald Trump himself, who, despite repeatedly claiming that he could not wait to do so, he didn't actually ever take the stand to testify under oath in his own defense.
Shocker!
But we will get into all of those details shortly with Heather Digby-Parton and Keith Barber. First, however, voters went to the polls on Tuesday in Kentucky, Oregon, Idaho, Georgia, and California for presidential primaries, down-ticket primaries, special elections, and more. So far, I have not come across too many problems for voters at the polls. Though, as I always warn, sometimes it takes a while before they come to light, as it has begun to do following last week's primaries in Maryland, where Baltimore reported more votes than were actually cast in their results for reasons that still remain somewhat unclear today, particularly as the double-check canvassing of the results that brought the error to light, an error that was small but skewed some results in some local city council races. That error discovered that one USB drive containing results had not yet been counted, which would seem to have lowered the number of reported results rather than resulting in an over-reporting of results. So it's still a little foggy what happened there. The good news is it was discovered through the normal procedures, the normal canvassing procedures that take place after an election in Baltimore. So that's good. I'll keep my eye on that. And there was also a problem in Maryland's Prince George's County, where a woman who said she had been a registered voter for 45 years has voted in every election since she was 18 years old, went to her polling place only to find that she was not on the voting rolls anymore for reasons that also still remain unexplained. So we will keep our eyes on that as well. Hopefully we don't hear more such reports along those lines.
And it's one of the reasons why you repeatedly during election seasons remind people, hey, you know, set a reminder, periodically check your registration to make sure that you weren't purged.
And by nothing else, do it by going to vote during primaries when you'll, you know, can make sure you're on the rolls, at least as of the primaries. So I'm keeping my eyes on that. Also this week in Kentucky, there were a number of calls to the state's election fraud hotline. That's worth keeping an eye on as well, given Kentucky's very rich history of election fraud, particularly vote buying and vote selling. One of the calls to the hotline was, in fact, related to that. We'll see what that turns into. And in my favorite battleground state of Georgia, according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution on Tuesday, on a Georgia election day with packed ballots, solid turnout, and short lines, the biggest hiccup came when the state's voter information page buckled under the load of high traffic. The My Voter page went offline for about an hour during the primary elections on Tuesday afternoon, leaving voters unable to check their precinct locations.
Well, that's not helpful.
To find registration information or to view sample ballots, not helpful at all. Election officials say, don't worry, they'll be prepared for the presidential election in November when millions more people are expected to participate compared with the primary. Feel better? According to Gabe Sterling, the chief operating officer for the Secretary of State's office, the problem occurred because the website's vendor, a company by the name of Salesforce, wasn't prepared to handle so many thousands of users at once. Even though isn't that the very point of what they're supposed to be able to handle on an election day? Nah, it's just a hiccup, right? I mean, they had one job, frankly.
Oh, goodness.
Anyway, election officials said turnout appeared to be higher than the presidential primary earlier this year in March in Georgia, when about 879,000 people participated. Tuesday's turnout was expected to exceed 1 million, including 551,000 early voters. So whatever the problem was, that the website just couldn't handle that much traffic all at once, let's hope they get that straightened out before November when the turnout will be much, much higher. Mail delays were also reported. They caused problems for some absentee voters whose ballots were not received at election offices by Tuesday. And Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger encouraged them to vote in person instead, which is all swell if you happen to be in town, since people often vote by absentee ballot because they are not there on election day. But timely service for mail-in ballots has frankly been a consistent problem in Georgia over the last several election cycles, and it looks like it still is, given that Republican Governor Brian Kemp just signed a bill about a week ago that will require all mail ballots to be tallied within an hour of polls closing. Well, this could clearly be a problem in November. You know, a lot of states allow those ballots that are mailed to the election offices that are postmarked prior to or on election day to arrive within a number of days after election day to allow those to be counted.
Right, because it's not the voters' fault.
Well, in Georgia, I guess it's your fault. If it doesn't show up and then get counted within 1 hour of polls closing, I guess it'll be tossed out entirely, at least according to this new law that was signed by the Republican governor in Georgia. So this could clearly be a problem in November, where there's going to be many more voters trying to vote by absentee or otherwise forced, if they don't, otherwise forced to vote on 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems at polling places across the state. Kind of like no good options there. I realize that sometimes these problems sort of seem minor, but A, they aren't if you happen to be a voter who is unable to vote by election day because of one of these hiccups, or you're somebody who did vote or tried to vote but couldn't vote, and, you know, B or C, wherever we are here, whatever problems occur in primaries with much lower turnout than in November can be expected to be multiplied, I don't know, tenfold during an actual presidential election. For now, however, I'm happy to say there haven't been too many of these issues reported on Tuesday or from primaries overall this season, but we will keep watching. As to actual results of on Tuesday, of note, incumbent Republican-appointed State Supreme Court Justice Andrew Pinson defeated former Democratic Congressman John Barrow in Georgia in an election for that Supreme Court justice seat. Barrow ran on the argument that the Georgia state constitution guarantees the right to an abortion in a state which has now imposed a six-week ban on the procedure before many women even know they're pregnant. As noted on yesterday's show, defeating Pinson, however, would have been an uphill climb in the state. No incumbent state Supreme Court justice has lost their seat in such an election for more than 100 years. Pinson, if you trust Georgia's 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems, defeated Barrow by a healthy 10-point margin. In Fulton County, Georgia, meanwhile, in Atlanta, District Attorney Fani Willis easily won her primary over Democratic challenger Christian Weiss-Smith. Just in case anyone was wondering or under the impression that Willis might face blowback for the RICO charges she brought against Donald Trump and 18 co-conspirators for their attempt to steal Georgia's 2020 election, or for the controversy surrounding her romantic involvement with one of her fellow prosecutors on the case, well, Willis reportedly destroyed her more progressive opponent by 74 points in the Democratic, very Democratic area. So she's all but certain now to win re-election to a second term as DA this November against Republican Courtney Kramer, who ran uncontested on Tuesday. Similarly, Republican-appointed Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee, who is overseeing the actual Trump RICO trial, he also destroyed his opponent by 66 points. He was endorsed by both Republican Governor Brian Kemp, who appointed him, and former Democratic Governor Roy Barnes. There was no presidential primary on the ballot in Georgia on Tuesday. They held their presidential primaries on Super Tuesday back in March, but there was presidential primaries in Oregon on Tuesday, at least on the Democratic side. Trump ran uncontested on the GOP ballot, but Biden, who, like Trump, has already won enough delegates to clinch his party's nomination at the conventions this summer, he easily bested the only other name on the ballot, Marianne Williamson, with 71% of the ballots tallied as we go to air in the all-vote-by-mail state. Biden won more than 88% of the Democratic vote to Williamson's 7% and another 5% for various write-in candidates. In Kentucky, however, which also held presidential contests on Tuesday, it was a different story where Trump had been losing about 20% of the Republican vote in state after state over recent months to the ghost of Nikki Haley, who dropped out months ago. Trump performed a little bit better on Tuesday. He picked up about 85% of his party's vote in Kentucky, losing just about 15%, however, to both Haley and the ghosts of Ron DeSantis, Chris Christie, and others, and about 3.5 points to uncommitted. Nikki Haley, by the way, just before we go to air, after running against Trump in the primaries, claiming he was unfit for office, etc., well, she announced she plans to vote for Donald Trump this November.
Of course she does.
Very courageous of her, isn't it? Well done, Nikki. On the Democratic side, however, in Kentucky, which does have a Democratic governor, It looked a lot more like Alabama from a week or so ago, a rare state where Trump had outpaced Biden among his own party's voters this season. In Kentucky on Tuesday, Trump managed to pick up about 85% of his party's vote, but Biden managed to pick up only just over 71%. A pretty weak showing, if you ask me, even in Kentucky, with about 18% going to the uncommitted line, which has served as a stand-in this cycle for those Democrats who oppose Biden's position on Israel. Another 10 points went to the combined ghost candidacies of Marianne Williamson and Dean Phillips, though it should be noted that with the presidential contests already being locked up, turnout had plunged to less than 200,000 votes on the Democratic side in Kentucky. That's about a third of the turnout in the state's Democratic presidential primary back in 2020. And finally, for now, there was also a contest out here in California where Republicans Mike Boudreau and Vince Fong were vying for the U.S. House seat vacated by former GOP House Speaker Kevin McCarthy after he was ousted by fellow Republicans and subsequently retired from Congress. Boudreau and Fong, both Republicans, finished first and second in an earlier primary in California where the top two vote-getters, regardless of party, move on to the general election. That was what we had on Tuesday. We already did presidential primaries back in March. So just that special election on Tuesday. AP called the race on Tuesday night, about 30 minutes after the close of polls, for Vince Fong winning handily over Boudreau, a county sheriff, by about 40 points. As of right now, with about 87% of the vote tallied as we go to air, Fong is a California state assemblyman. He was a former McCarthy aide. He was endorsed by both Trump and McCarthy. He'll now finish out the rest of McCarthy's term, and the pair will face off once again in November in the general election, though as incumbent, Fong will also be seen as the favorite to win a fall term in the fall. There are no primaries next week, as much of the country, I guess, will be on break over the week following Memorial Day. But on June 4th, voters in Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, South Dakota, and Washington, D.C. will be doing their civic duty and voting in what may be their last chance to make sure that they are registered as they think they are before this November's more critical than ever presidential election. All right, let's take a quick break here, and we will come back with the latest in Donald Trump's first of four criminal trials, which is now nearing its finish line in the great state of New York with our panelists Heather Digby Parton and Keith Barber. That's next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to do it. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate to make an automated monthly pledge of any amount you like, or even just a one-time only contribution to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. The fight for voting rights, civil rights, and to save our planet continues. Please help us continue that fight independently over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate right now. Go ahead, do it right now. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
Big news today. The Trump trial is coming to an end. And just like Stormy Daniels said, it was over much more quickly than expected.
I know why he can't hold his head up high. Stormy Daniels.
Oh, yes. You know what that means.
She went through all the legal channels.
Yes, it's our midweek New York Trump trial catch-up. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. The defense has rested. It rested on Tuesday in Donald Trump's criminal trial in New York, where he's facing 34 felony counts for falsifying business records in order to allegedly hide a hush money payment made to porn star Stormy Daniels by Trump's then-lawyer Michael Cohen just weeks before the 2016 election, all in hopes of hiding his sexual encounter with Ms. Daniels in order to help him win that year's presidential election. And it worked. The scheme was a success. The secret payment to Daniels, a violation of campaign finance law, according to New York prosecutors, was kept under wraps, as were the reimbursements for that payment to Michael Cohen, which Donald Trump made in just 12 easy monthly payments by signed checks over the course of the next year while he was serving as president in the White House. Cohen spent much of the past week under oath testifying about the scheme on the witness stand as the prosecution's star witness. He had been sentenced himself to 3 years in federal prison for his part in the scheme some years earlier, as well as for lying to federal officials about that and about Trump's dealings with Russia during the run-up to the same election in 2016. Cohen performed well under direct examination, according to most legal analysts, and even under much of the cross-examination by Trump's lead attorney, Todd Blanche, at least until Blanche was able to catch Cohen in what appeared to be Cohen misremembering of the content of one of his dozens of phone calls with Donald Trump as the scheme, the hush money scheme, was rushed to completion just before Election Day. Cohen might have misremembered one of the phone calls on October 24th, 2016. It might have happened instead on the 25th or the 26th. Still, it was a small but important win for Team Trump, who had been hoping to paint Cohen as an out-of-control liar, hell-bent on revenge against Donald Trump for not hiring him to be part of his presidential administration. That hiccup during the testimony by the final star witness for the prosecution, who finished his testimony last week, might have been considered a win for the defense, who began and ended their own case this week with only two witnesses, one of whom was decidedly not Donald Trump, despite his repeated vows for months. And even on a regular basis while speaking to reporters at the courthouse during the trial, that yes, he really, really was looking forward to taking the stand under oath in his own defense.
I would have no problem testifying. I didn't do anything wrong. I'm testifying. I tell the truth. I mean, all I can do is tell the truth.
Do you plan to testify in court?
Probably so. I would like to. I mean, I think so.
Will you testify in your own defense?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
You'll take the stand.
I look forward to.
Sure he does. The two witnesses included a paralegal who testified to the admission of certain emails into evidence and a guy by the name of Robert Costello, another former Trump lawyer and close friend of still another Trump lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. Costello had been hoping to land Michael Cohen as a client after the payout scheme came to light and Cohen was raided by the FBI. Costello's job was to sign up Cohen as a client and keep him from flipping against the then president. Emails from Costello to Cohen included comments such as, quote, Rudy said this communication channel must be maintained. Sleep well tonight. You have friends in high places, Costello told Cohen. And from Costello to one of his own law partners about Cohen, quote, our issue is to get Cohen on the right page without giving the appearance that we are following instructions from Giuliani or the president. As Heather Digby Parton of Salon observes today, quote, when Cohen didn't sign on with him right away, he told his law partner Cohen was, quote, slow playing us and the president. What should I say to this a-hole? He's playing with the most powerful man on the planet. Didn't he know who he was messing with? Quipped Parton. The cross-examination did not go well for Costello, with the judge, Justice Juan Merchan, at one point clearing the courtroom, even of the press, to tell Costello that his obnoxious attitude, his comments, and glaring at the judge on the stand was contemptuous. Judge Merchan said, quote, I'm putting you on notice that your conduct is contemptuous, according to court transcripts. Later revealed that Merchan was telling Costello, quote, if you try to stare me down one more time, I will remove you from the stand. I will strike his entire testimony. Do you understand me? Trump's lawyer responded, quote, "Yes, Judge, I understand." When Costello asked if he could say something, Mershon said, quote, "No, this is not a conversation. You don't get to give me side eye and you don't roll your eyes," Mershon warned. Costello said he understood. That was on Monday. On Tuesday, the defense rested their star witness, Costello, after he had completed his testimony. Donald Trump, despite his dozens of claims that, yes, he would absolutely testify in his own defense, did not do so, to the surprise of absolutely no one. With both the prosecution and defense cases complete and the court off this week on both Wednesday and Friday and again on Monday for the Memorial Day holiday, the jury was dismissed until closing arguments in the case begin next Tuesday, followed by the jury deliberation on whether, for the first time in U.S. history, a U.S. president would be found guilty of felony crimes and perhaps face as much as up to 4 years in prison for having done so. Joining us now, once again, as they have for many of the past 5 or 6 weeks, what now could be our final New York Trump trial midweek catch-up with a K program, since we'll be off next week over the Memorial Day holiday week, and there could be a verdict by then, are the great Heather Digby Parton, award-winning salon columnist and longtime blogger and proprietor at Digby's Hullabaloo, and former attorney and lifelong Republican Keith Barber, who now blogs on the law and Constitution at the Progressive Daily Coast. Welcome back to both of you. Catch up, kids. Glad to have you back here, guys.
Glad to be here.
Okay, Heather. Yes. Let me start with you, Heather. You wrote about this at Salon today in a piece headlined "Along Came Robert Costello, Trump's crime boss maneuvering blows up in court." So, Heather, did Costello really undermine Trump's case as you see it? And why was he even called in the first place in the defense case here?
Well, a lot of people are asking that question, and I don't really think that's a mystery at all. About why he was called. I think Trump insisted that he be called. See, Trump, you kind of alluded to it in your intro when you pointed out that Trump had always said that he was going to testify. You know, I want to testify. Of course, I'm going to testify. Blah. You know, he always says that, and then he never does. This was, I think, Trump saw Costello. I mean, he's been aware of Costello this whole time, right? As was shown by the emails between Cohen and Costello, in which Costello was made it very clear that he was part of a back channel, mediation between Giuliani and Trump and Cohen to try and keep him on board and not flip. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But Costello was called before Congress. He's been out there screaming this whole time. Probably he and Rudy have cooked this up. That he needed to testify, that he has all this information, that he needs to do, he can refute everything if they just put him on the stand. He's been saying this. They even demanded that he go and testify before the grand jury a year ago, which he did, which, as many lawyers have pointed out, was really stupid of them to call him, knowing that the prosecution already knew what he had to say.
Right.
Was a little bit shooting themselves in the foot. But the truth is, the defense lawyers no doubt didn't want to call him because look at what happened, and they knew it would happen. But Trump saw him last week testifying before Congress.
Yep.
That weaponization committee called him, you know, to get up there and say that, you know, Michael Cohen's a liar. While Cohen was testifying, now this was on the Wednesday that the court was off, they had him up there. Hopefully, I think the idea was is that it would make the news and everyone would see that everything Michael Cohen was saying was a big lie.
And
Costello was bombastic. He was, you know, rude. He was everything that he later showed himself to be on the stand.
And he was basically, Costello was making the case that, Michael Cohen is lying. He told me way back when that he had nothing on Donald Trump, that all of this stuff about reimbursements was all stuff and nonsense. And he knows it. And he's all lying from top to bottom.
Exactly. And I think Trump heard that and went, oh, great. You know, this is really going to work. Although, you know, I mean, when the prosecution, you know, got a hold of Costello on the stand, you know, they pointed out and you know, through Cohen's testimony and the emails, that Cohen didn't trust him. And so, of course, you know, was saying whatever. Just, you know, he didn't want to cross Trump, you know, with his lieutenant there. Mm-hmm. So that became very clear. But I think the reason that he got called was simply that Trump saw Costello as a, you know, because of his performance in that testimony last week, Trump saw him as a good stand-in for himself, right? Mm. He can't get up there, and he understands, I think, at least that much, that he couldn't expose himself to cross-examination. But Costello could get up there, and he's a rude, you know, he'd take control of the courtroom. He would put it out there. He would say it. He wouldn't take any guff
right.
from that crooked judge and from that, you know, that challenged prosecutor, yeah. and he'd get the job done. And he forced his defense team to put him on the stand, and it was a gigantic mistake. I'll be interested to hear Keith's view of that from the lawyer perspective.
Yeah, and I mean, he was bombastic, he was loud, and sure enough, within minutes, as I noted from the transcript, the judge was threatening him with contempt of court, which I guess we could have expected from Donald Trump, in fact, had he testified. Other than that, of course, it's always smart to follow, whatever ideas Rudy cooks up. Keith, I know you've got some thoughts on the various weaknesses of both the prosecution and the defense's case, and we will get to that in a bit. But at the end of last week, you know, after Michael Cohen had completed his testimony, all the experts out there were talking about it as a win for the defense. Cohen was caught in what they characterized as a lie, even though it kind of seems like a mix-up. But, you know, a win's a win. They were, saying that, that one dispute about when he had this phone call with Trump means that you have to forget about everything Michael Cohen said. It's all a lie. But then, as Heather said, along came Robert Costello. What effect might that have on the jurors as they begin deliberating next week after closing statements with Costello's testimony seemingly the most fresh in their mind? Was it as disastrous as some like Heather are suggesting?
Well, we'll see how disastrous it will be. But I think it was really bad. I mean, to the extent that the jury has a choice of believing either Cohen or Costello. And that's kind of a choice that the defense counsel decided to make for the jury.
Uh-huh.
I think that Costello is a bad choice in that regard. The jury is more inclined to believe Cohen.
Uh-huh.
Cohen had, you know, a nibbling little mistake, just, a trifling detail that I think was overblown by the media in general, mm-hmm. and was adequately rehabbed by the prosecution in redirect. On the other hand, Costello, not only did he just appear as a bad witness and obviously in front of the jury get reprimanded by the judge. I mean, the jury knew what they were being sent out of the room for when the judge sent them out of the room.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did that happen, but his testimony was again and again on cross-examination from the prosecution contradicted by his own emails. One of them is the example you cited in the introduction, mm-hmm. where, you know, the setup to that the prosecution used was they asked Costello if he had any animosity towards Cohen, and he said, oh, no, of course not. I'm completely objective about this. Well, then they show him the email that calls Cohen, as you put it, an a-hole.
Mm-hmm.
Just the jury's got to be sitting there rolling their eyes, knowing that Costello looked like a hired gun presented to contradict Cohen's case. You were talking about how he, would come across like Trump. Well, that's probably true. And he came across probably too much like Trump.
Yeah, I mean, he really comes across like a thug, like a bad, gangster movie villain or something. Heather, have we yet seen Trump offer an excuse for his own failure to testify under oath in this case, as he has long promised that he would do?
Not that I've heard. I mean, when he did his little hallway appearance yesterday, the press shouted out at him, hey, why didn't you testify? And he just turned around and walked away. So I don't think he had yet figured out whatever absurd excuse he's going to come up with. But he'll come up with something, some reason. I didn't need to. The case should have been thrown out that minute. I've got better things to do. I mean, my favorite thing, just to digress for a second, is when he came out in the morning yesterday, or on Tuesday.
On Tuesday.
He said, he said, well, we're going to rest today. He goes, wait, well, I'm not going to rest. I can't rest. I'm not allowed to rest.
I never rest
because, of course, he's trying to refute the widely accepted, you know, knowledge that he's been sleeping through most of his trial.
Right.
So true. I just thought that was funny.
True. And I laughed at that, too. But I also have to say, I did see something where apparently Trump claimed that he was not going to testify because he was limited by the gag order.
What?
That somehow his testimony would trigger the gag order, which, of course, is
nonsense.
He
said that again?
Yeah.
Of course he did.
God. Well, the judge admonished him for that in court. The judge sat there and told him, you are not restricted by the gag order to what you say on the stand. It applies only to extrajudicial statements. It doesn't apply once you walk up to that stand and take the oath.
Of course, but his MAGA base doesn't know that.
Keith, what effect does that sort of thing have on the jury, that he does not give testimony after all? Is that... does a jury take notice of that when a defendant does not testify on their own behalf, or is that all just more sort of fodder for the media and for the voting public to make sense of, rather than for jurors to hash out at this point?
The jury will be strongly admonished by the judge to not consider Donald Trump's failure to testify. That the judge will advise the jury that is his absolute right under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution, and that they shall not consider it, that the responsibility was on the prosecution to prove their case, not on Trump to disprove his disprove the case. And that's the instructions the jury will get.
And speaking of that case, Keith, you dropped me some email last night about what you saw as the greatest weaknesses in both of the cases, both the case for the prosecution and the defense, as of the end of testimony in any event. Let's start with the weakness in the prosecution's case, because it kind of mirrors what I've been arguing here, or at least asking about here during our midweek catch-up shows for the past several weeks. What is the biggest flaw as you see it in the prosecution case as it is set to soon go to the jury?
Well, the prosecution has proven a lot of things that could implicate Trump and result in a guilty verdict. But kind of the missing link is that you have these pretty much indisputably fraudulent statements and entries on the ledgers and accounts payable. Mm-hmm. What you don't have is that Trump either entered those himself or told someone to do it. Nobody's taken the stand and said, yeah, I made the illegal entries because Trump told me to. That's what's missing. One of the things I said in the email to you was that if the prosecution loses the case for that reason, that the failure to call Weisselberg, who might have been able to connect that dot, will loom pretty large.
Why did they fail to call Trump Organization Chief Financial Officer Alan Weisselberg, who's serving time for perjury, by the way, for lying on the stand in Trump's last trial on the civil fraud trial, I think it was. Very difficult to keep track. But he could have come. They could have dragged him out of Rikers to take the stand here. I mean, he was sort of the third person in the room. You got Cohn saying one thing, Trump suggesting another, not coming on the stand to say it. But Weisselberg seems like he could be the decisive vote here. Why didn't they call him to the stand?
Well, they already had one perjurer as a big witness. I think that they didn't want two. I think they were also concerned that Weisselberg would just plead the fifth.
He would not have to answer if he heard.
Yeah.
I mean, how does that incriminate him if he's participating in the conspiracy at that point?
Yeah, absolutely. The same way it incriminated Cohen, and Cohen went to jail for it.
So the only person right now who says that Donald Trump knew this was a scheme to secretly pay off the hush money payment that Michael Cohen had made, the only one who has testified to that is Cohen. And the defense case here is that Donald Trump, he just knew nothing about it. He just thought he was paying off a retainer
for help to Michael Cohen for 12 months, $35,000 a month.
And that gets to what I regard as the biggest weakness in the defense.
Yeah.
Is that they don't have a plausible narrative. They don't have a plausible story to tell the jury of what did happen, that the jury can nod their heads with and agree and say, okay, we're going to acquit him because, you know, it hasn't been proven beyond reasonable doubt that didn't happen. So that's the biggest weakness in the defense's case here, is the ability to tell a story to the jury that is believable. And the story that, like you just presented, that Trump didn't know anything, is just very implausible. It strains the facts that have been presented right from the beginning of this, that started with David Pecker's testimony, where they planned to do all of these things, and which corroborates much of what Cohen has had to testify to. And, you know, as I think Heather and I agreed before the trial started, one of the most important witnesses that people were not talking about was Pecker. And I think that that will remain true as the jury deliberates.
Because Pecker sets up the idea that, yes, they were trying to do whatever they could to keep these women silent about these affairs. They were willing to pay them off to catch and kill the story, et cetera. And
that Cohen was the guy who was taking care of all that.
Was the linchpin to all of this. Mm-hmm. So,
and that Cohen, as early as with the McDougal story, was talking to Trump, and it's on tape, about setting up shell corporations to conceal these papers.
Now, Keith, the prosecution has to make their case, and I'm sure the judge will admonish the jury that this is up to the prosecution to make and prove their case, tell the story, explain what happened, and present the evidence for that. But what you're saying when it comes to the defense is, even though they don't have to have a story in response, as an attorney yourself, longtime attorney, you're suggesting that the defense in this case still needs to present a story anyway to give a plausible alternative to what the prosecution is arguing?
Yeah, it's basically it. Juries like to have a story, an explanation for what happened that makes sense to them. I think everybody does.
Gotcha.
And you get in that jury room, and the prosecution has a story that makes sense. The prosecution has a cohesive story that makes sense. It's supported by all of this sort of stuff. Okay. Yes, there's that one missing link I talked about, but it's supported by a whole lot of stuff. And it's a story that makes sense.
Gotcha.
To the extent that the defense has a narrative, it's not one that makes a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, because they haven't really presented one as of yet. Maybe that will come in the summation. I'm not asking for a prediction from you here, Keith Barber, but if you had to be representing one side or the other right now, which one would you rather be representing?
Oh, that's interesting. I think I'd rather be representing the prosecution, because then my conscience could be clear.
There you go. Heather, what is your biggest concern about this case as it heads to the jury, likely as early as the coming week?
Well, obviously, the biggest concern is that he will be acquitted. Because, and not just, I think it would be fair enough if he was, you know, I kind of believe in the justice system, generally speaking, and I can, this having followed this case closely, I could see where they could do that. They just say they didn't see, you know, they had reasonable doubt that Trump was, I mean, I wouldn't agree with it, but I would respect it if that's what they came up with. But
that would take all 12
that
jurors,
would take all of them,
right?
Yeah, and that would be huge. Yeah, that would be huge, and much bigger than a mistrial in my view, because a mistrial, you can kind of go, well, there was one ringer in there, and, you know, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. But this would be, hey, wow, you know, this is, and it would shake my faith that in what I'm seeing with my own eyes or
reality,
reading these
transcripts. Shake your faith, not in the justice system,
I mean,
but in
reality.
Yeah,
I watched the whole OJ trial. So this would not be the first time that that's happened to me.
Uh-huh.
However, the political ramifications are gigantic if he is acquitted. Mm-hmm. It would strengthen him in a way that, I mean, part of his strength is this belief in him as being a superhero among way too many people, and that the guy is just, he is all, everything he's saying is right. it was rigged, but the people stood up and they actually defied it and all that. And I really, really, really hope that doesn't happen. I mean, maybe it would reinforce the belief in the justice system this one time, but you know, these MAGA people, they'll, the next time if something happens, they'll go revert right back to saying it's all rigged. So it, I am really not looking forward to that. I really hope that that is not what the outcome is, for, you know, more reasons than one, but specifically for that.
Keith, what does the jury now need to specifically determine in order to reach that verdict one way or another? What do they need to decide?
Well, they need to determine that Trump either made or caused to be made the fraudulent entries.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're going to amplify it to a felony, I suppose there is the possibility of a split verdict here where they could just find him guilty of the misdemeanors and not say that it was done for the purpose of concealing another crime. And the interesting thing about the
because that's Keith, that's what bumps it up from a misdemeanor for these falsified checks and so forth. It has to be done in the furtherance of another crime. That makes it the felony.
That's to conceal it, when done to conceal another crime.
Right.
That's what amplifies it to a felony. And okay. I guess they could decide that didn't happen, but that the misdemeanors did.
Okay.
I mean, that's a possibility. But if one of the interesting things about this is that the prosecution has three different theories of what crimes, you know, Trump was trying to conceal or were trying to be concealed.
Uh-huh.
And what the judge has ruled or is apparently going to rule is that in the jury instructions, the jury does not have to be unanimous on which of those crimes were being concealed. So four of them could think that it's crime A, four of them crime B, and four of them crime C, and that would still be a unanimous verdict that, you know, Trump did it to conceal a crime, which is, I thought that was an interesting interpretation of it by the judge. I'm sure that on appeal that would be challenged by Trump's attorneys if there was that kind of split by the jury. But it'll be interesting to see what happens.
So they have to determine whether, in fact, he falsified these 34 documents, and actually each one of them is its own count. So I guess they could say, oh, he falsified the checks, but not the invoices or something like that. But in each case, they have to go through one by one through those 34 counts, decide if he actually falsified those things, and then if he did,
or caused to be falsified,
and that's an important element here as well, I think. But if they determine that, then the question is, did he do it to conceal another crime? That bumps it up from a misdemeanor to a felony. So that's what the jury, as I understand it, will have to decide in each of those 34 cases. Heather, I spent some time in my old home state of Missouri over the weekend for a family funeral with a lot of both right-wingers and those who do not consider themselves to be right-wingers. And I was sort of struck by the fact that one of them, in fact, said, well, doesn't that seem kind of strange that all of a sudden, just before the election, Trump is being forced to face all of this legal peril? And this was somebody who is, you know, does not consider themselves a Trump supporter. And I had to explain that, well, you know, in this case, the investigation actually began in 2019. So it seems to defy common sense that they were investigating him in 2019 to interfere with his election in 2024. But Trump's repeated lies here that we all laugh at on this show and everywhere else actually do work, it seems to me. And I'm wondering, whose fault is that? Is that our fault in the media? Are we screwing this up yet again, Heather?
I think so. I mean, people like us, you and I, Brad, we have an audience, and I think that audience is well informed. But generally speaking, no. I think that the media has not been, you know, done this properly. Mm. I think that and maybe you disagree with me on this, I don't know, because a lot of people do. But I've been saying from the very beginning that the idea of blacking out Trump after the January 6th insurrection and saying, we're not going to show him on our air, we're not going to show any of this, and nobody gets to hear him, you're not going to see him, we're not going to do that, we'll report on him. but we're not going to let you see him. I have felt from the moment they did that, that it was a huge mistake, because people have to see him in order to be reminded of just what a complete lunatic he is. You can't get it from the reporting. The reporting just fly, you know, you hear, you know, Rachel Maddow say something, or you hear, you know, what some Jake Tapper or something like that, they say it and it just kind of goes right over. And that's I'm just talking about people who are actually watching cable news. Mm-hmm. It was a big mistake to do that. And, you know, furthermore, we're still in the midst of the, you know, the ongoing problem with this idea of, you know, being fair and balanced and both sides do it and ensuring, you know, how much time did they spend on Biden's age and how much time are they spending on looking at this polling as if it actually, you know, is the most important story in politics right now. And how much time are they spending telling people what Trump has in mind for a second term? And I think the media has failed. I mean, let me tell you something. A poll came out that was reported on by The Guardian this week that showed that 58% of people in America think we're in a recession. I'm sorry. That is a media failure.
Yep.
There is no other way to explain that. Yep. If people believe we're in a recession, despite the fact that we have the best jobs record in 50 years, that inflation is coming down, that there's GDP, the stock market is roaring, this is ridiculous. And it's a big media failure, and I have absolutely no idea what to do about it.
No, I join you in that as well. We have to include myself in there as much as I try to think about it every day and do a good job on it every day. We collectively, as the media, are failing. We are failing the nation. And I just hope the nation figures it out on their own. Keith, you're down there in the Villages, a far right Trump loving enclave in Florida. What do you hear? I'm just curious from the average civilian about what's going on in this New York case, if anything at all. And has any of this affected the way that, you know, those who might have voted for Trump in the past now think about him from your anecdotal observations and conversations down there?
Yeah, we don't have a whole lot of talking about politics down here. I think, to avoid...
They have to live together, you know.
Yeah, to avoid the fallout that would occur. I think it's tempting to blame the media. And I suppose there's something to that, particularly what a part of the media that has come to cater to this. But the fact of the matter is that we now have an entire major party that is built around wackadoodle conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. You can argue about when it started. I think it really started with the birther stuff, which Donald Trump rode to national prominence and rode to, the nominee of the Republican Party on. And once you started doing stuff as crazy as that, that opened the door for all of the other crazy stuff that we've seen, all the QAnon stuff, all of the, the election stuff, all of it. And it's just become nuts. And the Republican Party has let it happen. You've had the Speaker of the House parade down to show the president his support at this criminal trial of hush money payment to a porn star. I mean, it's just incredible.
If it's not the media's fault, then whose fault is it? Of course, you're an attorney. We always love to blame the lawyers, but Heather and I are sitting here willing to take the blame. If it's not the media, whose fault is this at that point?
It's the Republican Party's. They have allowed this. They have allowed their party to be corrupted with lies in a manner that seemed incomprehensible just 10 years ago.
Heather, let me give you one more before we get out regarding the Florida case, the stolen documents case where Donald Trump stole a whole bunch of national security, highly classified national security documents as he was leaving office. His own appointed U.S. District Court Judge Eileen Cannon has put this trial off, has slow walked this thing. But some documents were unsealed in Trump's in this case, specifically some documents unsealed from the time when the FBI had obtained a search warrant to be executed at Mar-a-Lago.
after more than a year of Trump refusing to return the national security documents to the government. So Trump put out a fundraising notice today concerning some of those unsealed documents, saying that the FBI was, quote, locked and loaded and ready to kill him during the Mar-a-Lago raid to get those documents, the search warrant that was executed. I got about a minute here for you to field that softball if you would like.
Thank you. Well, Steve Bannon said that this was an assassination attempt. So that's where they've gone with this. It's all over the right-wing media. They are completely running with it without even a thought for the fact that it is complete and utter BS. The FBI, this is a routine thing in any search warrant that the FBI can be armed. I mean, if somebody had come running up with an AR-15 and tried to gun them down as they were delivering the warrant, they were authorized, as they are in any other case like this, to defend themselves. That's all that was. Trump wasn't there that day.
What?
They knew he wasn't there that day.
What?
And they didn't show up in uniforms. They knocked very politely. Hi, we're here. Do you mind? We'd just like to serve you a warrant. They sent out a lawyer, Christina Bobb, the new, yesterday was indicted. In Arizona,
yes.
And is running the RNC's election integrity unit.
Yes.
I mean, this is complete nonsense, but it is an interesting story for us to think about, because this is how the right-wing media and Donald Trump, and just what Keith was saying, the entire Republican Party, are able to push out some completely nonsensical talking point and have it just take off. And you, from now on, I'm sure 50% of the country, I shouldn't say 50%, a large number of our fellow Americans will believe that the FBI was attempting to assassinate Donald
Trump. An assassination
attempt.
And that's
just how this works.
Where, yeah, Donald Trump was not even there to be assassinated.
Right.
Sounds like an assassination attempt cooked up by Rudy Giuliani, of course.
Exactly.
Hey, I got to get out. Thank you guys so much for all of these weeks keeping us up to date, catching us up on the New York Trump trial. Don't know if it'll be over by the time we next meet, but I greatly appreciate both of your insights over these weeks. And God willing, we'll have a few more trials to do it again in the not too distant future. Heather Digby Parton is the columnist at Salon.com and at her own long-running blog, digbysblog.net. You can also follow her on the Twitters, and I hope you do, at Digby56. You'll find Keith Barber writing these days over at DailyCoast.com under the name Keith DB, and he can be found on the site still known as Twitter at KeithDB80. Thanks, guys. I don't know when we'll talk again, but I hope it's soon.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot, Brad.
All right, we got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. All of this made possible by those of you who hit a donate button or go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Thank you in advance. Drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodon's the site, still known as Twitter, I am the Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you, who drop by bradblog.com/donate.